The following program is a commentary program. The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of Dale Jackson, his guests, and callers. They do not represent the views of Cumulus Broadcasting, its management, or this station. It's live. It's local. It's the Dale Jackson Show on News Talk 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN Online and WVNN.com, and on your smartphone on iHeartRadio.
Talk 770 AM 92.5 FM WVNN News Time 707. I have not touched on the ferry thing at all, but let me just say this. They're calling the guy who was the captain a murderer. Okay, I just want to address this for just a quick second here. You know how we are an American society that likes to do like we like to do. We have a false outrage, and we like to Monday morning quarterback and all these other things. But this is a horrible accident. Unless you can tell me that this guy did this on purpose, it's pretty hard to say. This guy should just stood there at the helm of the ship, like in the movie The Titanic, and went down with it. I feel like it's a bit absurd for us to say that. I mean, from watching it, we can very clearly say that. But you have the South Korean president calling this guy a murderer. I mean, I listen to this, and I'm just like, I can't believe it. Speaking for the families in much of our country, South Korean President Park Geun-hye likened the actions of the captain and some crew members to murder. The captain of the South Korean ship, Lee Jun-sik, is already facing a series of criminal charges for his role in the sinking. And again, if he did something wrong, fine, I get it. If they said, hey, everybody stay down there, we're going to take off, then yeah, lock him up. The actions of the captain and some of the crew are all absolutely unacceptable, unforgivable actions that are akin to murder. She said that her and other South Koreans were filled with rage and horror. The latest arrest of the crew members bring the total number detained to 7 as authorities investigate what went wrong on the ship as it sailed towards a popular holiday island. The people who run it have posted an apology on their website. I'm sure that will do a lot. We pray for the victims who lost their precious loved ones during the accident. We prostrate ourselves before the victims' families and beg for forgiveness. We apologize to all the people who are grieving for the loss of loved ones. Also, we apologize to the people who had injuries, major or minor, due to this accident. We wish them a speedy recovery. It was unclear when this was posted, but it's up on their website. When they call people murderers, and again, the investigation is still underway, so we may hear a lot more. A radio transcript released by authorities suggests that passengers on the ship couldn't reach lifeboats to escape because the ship tilted so quickly that it left many of them unable to move. Please notify the Coast Guard. Our ship is in danger. The ship is rolling right now. A crew member on the ship first tells authorities in a fraught conversation that took place as the ferry was floundering. An unidentified crew member on the ship talked to two different vessel traffic service centers as the ship sank Wednesday. When one of the centers advises getting people into the life vest, the crew member replies that it is hard to get people to move. After the conversation switches to the other center, the crew member says the ship is leaned so far that passengers are unable to move. Are the passengers able to escape? The center says. The ship listed too much, so it's impossible. The center also urged the captain to take charge of the crisis. The captain should make the decision to make people escape, noting that he had a better understanding of the situation. Now, What are we hearing here? Well, okay, so what does this say? So you have a guy calling in, oh my God, we're sinking. They're saying, get the people off the boat. And the guy says, the boat is tilting so far to one side that we cannot get anyone off the boat. Let's pretend, okay? Let's pretend that's legitimate. Is he a murderer? Given all that, I don't know. I read that and I'm like, okay, I think that makes complete sense. The boat is completely tipped over, or it's tipping. People can't move. They're pinned down. And again, it's a horrible situation. But is it murder? I mean, I read these things. I don't see it. I really don't. Captain Lee has defended his order to delay the evacuation of the ferry. It is a fairly fast current and the water temperature was cold. I thought that abandoning the ship without discretion would make you drift off a fairly far distance and cause you a lot of trouble. At the same time, the rescue ship did not come and there were no fishing boats or supporting ships around to help at the time. But the first mate of the boat that responded to the emergency call disagreed. Quote, if the passengers had jumped in the water sooner, more people could have been rescued. Again, hindsight. Absolute hindsight. The ferry captain has been charged with abandoning his boat, negligence, causing bodily injury, not seeking rescue from other ships, and violating seaman's law. They gave more details about the accusations against the captain from the prosecutor. He said, Mr. Lee is charged with causing the ship to sink by failing to slow down when sailing the narrow route and making a turn excessively. Again, it doesn't sound like murder to me. That sounds like a horrible, stupid accident. Different worlds, different countries. I get it. I understand. Lee is also charged with failing to do the right thing to guide the passengers to escape and thereby leading to their death or injury. If convicted, the captain faces from 5 years to life in prison. This is just like the Malaysia thing. This is just like the Malaysia thing. The Malaysia airliner, what is it, MH370? It's a tragedy that the rest of the world can gawk and rubberneck at. And as they gawk and rubberneck, they can start demanding that this person and that person is responsible and should be held accountable. The captain wasn't at the helm when it started to sink. A third mate was at the helm. Authorities said Monday that four more crew members of the ferry had been detained, bringing the total number to seven. Two first helmsmen, one second helmsman, whatever those are, and the chief engineer are now under arrest. The chief prosecutor of the investigation said four crew members could face indictment on several charges. So I guess we arrest people without charges and we hold them. As well as the captain and two other crew members were arrested over the weekend. The question is, where was the captain? As the search goes on, the actions of the captain and crew remain under scrutiny. The captain was not in the steering room when the accident took place. He said he plotted the ship's course and then went to his cabin briefly to tend to something. It was then the captain said that the accident happened. A crew member described the third mate and identified only as Park, appeared in handcuffs with Captain Lee at the weekend. The third mate said she did not make the sharp turn, but the steering turned much more than usual. Park is facing charges including negligence and causing injuries leading to death. A technician with the surname Cho is also facing the same charges. The captain was one of those rescued soon after it began to sink, violating an internationally recognized rule that the captain must stay down with the vessel. Pretty much every law, rule, regulation, standard throughout the world says, yes, the captain must stay with the ship until all personnel are safely off the ship, certainly passengers. Now, I ask this question. You're this captain. The boat is sinking. The boat is completely on its side. Nobody can move. There's nothing you can do to the people who are already pinned down. What do you do? I want you to answer this question honestly to yourself for a second. What do you do? It's real easy, isn't it? Isn't it real easy for all of us to say, well, I'd go down with the ship. I'd stand there on the bow of the ship, or I'd stay inside the steering cabin, the control room, whatever they call it on a boat. I would stand there, and I would drown. How many of us would actually do that? How many? How many of us would actually do that? How many of us would stand there and die for absolutely no purpose? No? Okay, I'm just checking. Because the American media and the world media would have you believe that mostly guys would just stand there on the boat and say, well, sure, I'm waiting to die here. I mean, after all, this is a horrible accident. I am the captain of the ship. I guess I'll just stand here and die. No? Nobody? That's not what you would do? Okay, I just want to make sure. I just want to make sure, because that appears to be where all the outrage is located, and I think it's fake. Personally, it's fake outrage. It's absolutely fake outrage. Experts say, however, captains should stay on board until everyone is off. Oh, okay. Okay. Sure thing. 1-866-494-WVNN. 1-866-494-9866. We'd all just stay on the boat, right? We'd all just sit there on the boat, and we would just watch. We would just watch as the boat sank, and we would just sit there in sync with the boat, right? You're lying. Let me just say that. You're lying. It's the Dale Jackson Show, live and local, News Talk, 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN. Depend on it. Ooh, lots of heroes out there. I got to give you guys some props. 1-866-494-WVNN. 1-866-494-9866. Hey, if the law says go down with the ship, I'll go down with the ship. Is there a song to somebody, I'll go down with the ship? It sounds like, I believe it is some sort of hipster song. Anyway, I wouldn't. I'm just going to be a good thing I'm not a captain, right? Good thing I'm not a captain of a boat. CNN has broke this down. When the HMS Birkenhead, a British ship carrying troops, began to sink off the coast of South Africa in 1852, the captain and military officers on board famously allowed women and children to board the lifeboats first. The captain and many of the troops stayed on the ship until the last perishing in the ocean as the women and children made their way to safety. Their chivalrous act of self-sacrifice is considered to have helped set the standard for noble conduct at sea. Other displays of courage by captains and crews who put their passengers first have punctuated the decades since, like Captain Edward J. Smith, who went down with the Titanic. But such bravery has been conspicuously absent in two major maritime disasters in recent times. We already talked about Captain Lee Jong-sik of the boat in South Korea that sank. Excuse me, it's a Dido song. I've been corrected. It is a Dido song, which is pretty much the same thing as being a hipster song. Witnesses, and they go on, and they prompted comparisons to those of Captain Francesco Shintino, who was in command of the cruise ship Costa Concordia, which crashed into a reef off the Italian coast in 2002. Witnesses said Shinsetto jumped into a lifeboat to flee the ship, even though hundreds of passengers were still on board. In his trial, the captain said he fell into a lifeboat when the ship listed sharply. Sure, dude. He is now on charge. He's on trial for manslaughter, causing a maritime disaster, and abandoning ship with passengers still on board. That's a different situation. That ship did not sink. There was an accident, people died, but the ship did not sink. This other ship wrecked, and there's like 200 dead people. And we're going to criticize this guy for getting off the ship. The captain's first obligation is for the safety of his crew and passengers. He should stay on board until he knows everybody is safely evacuated. So what's he supposed to do? Does he tie himself to the boat and go down with it? Is he allowed to swim off the boat when it goes completely underwater? I want to know the rules before I am outraged at what he has done. I'm just wondering. Former Navy SEAL Cade Courtley said, you don't necessarily want a captain dying with the ship, but he has a responsibility for the safety of everybody on board that ship. Well, you heard numerous people tell you that the ship had listed so far, people were unable to move. The ship was on its side and unable to move. And we're going to sit here and we're going to cross our arms and scold him. I don't know. I'm not participating, folks. I don't buy it. I don't buy it. I just don't see how we can say this guy should have just stood there and died. That, to me, is ridiculous. But again, we've got a couple hundred dead people, and we're going to be outraged. So let's just string this guy up and be done with it, okay?
It's live. It's local. It's the Dale Jackson Show on News Talk 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN online at WVNN.com, and on your smartphone on iHeartRadio.
News Talk 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN News Time. It is 7:35 here on your Tuesday morning. We talked to Parker Griffin not too long ago. He had some unkind words for Troy University and the study on Medicaid that they had done. So we wanted to give the guy who did that study, Professor Scott Boyer, an opportunity to weigh in on that and give his thoughts on the Medicaid study about Medicaid expansion here in the state of Alabama. Let's welcome Scott to the show. Thanks for coming on, Scott.
Good morning, Dale. How are you?
It's good to have you back on the program. Let's talk a little bit about the Koch brothers here for just a quick second. Dr. Griffith said your study is bogus because, again, the Koch brothers funded it. What do you say to that?
Yeah, you know, you get this all the time, and if that's all he can say about the study, that's a pretty shaky argument. Yes, we're funded by the Koch brothers. Look at the funding sources of the two other studies that were put out there, the UAB study and the University of Alabama study. UAB, I can't imagine ever putting out a study that wouldn't be in favor of Medicaid expansion and greater spending on hospitals. Go figure, they're the lead research hospital in the state. Alabama study, Alabama Hospital Association supported that. So I think that you know, those studies also have funding issues, and ours is, you know, as we've been saying, and as I said to you last time I was on, is very innocent. The Koch Foundation gave money to encourage scholars to engage in free enterprise research, to encourage greater engagement with students. Our students now can major in economics. In 2015, they can pursue a master's in economics. These are pretty harmless investments that they're making relative to what might be going on in the other studies.
What did your study find? He also said your study wasn't a real study. It was a study of a study. That was part of his hook as well. I mean, obviously, he knows he's going to run into questions about your study when on the campaign trail. And he's got a pretty standard set of answers. One is to mention the Koch brothers. Two is to say it's not a real study. Any idea what that's about?
Yeah, so for a doctor, this is pretty disingenuous. You know, so replication is a big part of the scientific enterprise. And what we do is we take the University of Alabama Birmingham numbers, we look at them, and we say, what did you all do to get the really rosy results that you got? And lo and behold, one of the big things that they do that we take issue with is they assume a tax collection rate of about 8.5%. No other study in the Southeast comes close to that number. Most of them peg the tax collection rate somewhere between 4% and 6%. So to be at 8.5%, that's doing all of their heavy lifting to get this really nice revenue result. That is really what the main conversation's about that we're going back and forth with them on. So this is what scientists do. He knows this and knows better.
Now, when Dr. Griffith talks about your study, obviously he's not complimentary because it doesn't support his method or his idea that we should expand Medicaid in the state. Real quick, for those who aren't familiar with the study, Scott, tell the audience what your study found. Give us the overall view of what your study found when it comes to Medicaid expansion in the great state of Alabama.
Sure. So the way to understand our study is it's an argument against just one part of the UAB study. So University of Alabama, Birmingham says that Medicaid expansion is going to lead to a 50% increase in state incomes. That means that for every Alabamian, they'll go from making about $35,000 to making $50,000 by 2020. We're skeptical of that. What it also says, the UAB study says that Medicaid expansion is going to be a windfall for our state. So taxpayers are actually going to enjoy additional savings that we could put towards tax cuts, or we could fund the prisons, or all kinds of other government spending. We say that that's the part that's really problematic. In fact, if you just, look at standard tax collection rates, you look at the projections of spending under Medicaid, it's going to be a money loser for the state to the tune of about $450 million. So if you want to expand Medicaid, that's fine, if that's what people want to do. But let's not call it this great moneymaker for the state. And that's really kind of been our main message. We don't know about some of the claims being made in the UAB study, how much is it going to increase income or economic growth. But what we can say with pretty good confidence is that it's not going to be something that leads to our state revenue in the state being really in surplus.
So it seems to me like your message is essentially one of, if you want to give people better health care, then yes, throw a bunch of money at it, and that might potentially lead to better outcomes. But if you want to make the argument that it's going to create a bunch of jobs and it's going to be a cash net winner for the state of Alabama, that's a flawed argument.
That's exactly right. So if you want better health care for your residents in your state, and you want to give them that security that comes with Medicaid coverage, that's fine. But let's acknowledge that we're going to have to pay something for it. There are no free lunches. And we also say that the notion that it's going to create 30,000 jobs is just absurd. There aren't a bunch of doctors sitting around just kind of waiting to be employed thanks to a Medicaid expansion. And, in fact, many poor people are getting health care now, so there's not going to be this big sudden transition from zero health care to all kinds of health care demand. They're just going to emergency rooms now for their care.
You make an interesting point. There aren't a bunch of doctors sitting around waiting to be employed by a Medicaid expansion. And that seems to be sort of the argument they're making, isn't it? But they're not only making the argument about doctors' jobs, they're talking about other types of jobs, too. Is there any truth to any of that?
Well, it starts with the doctor's jobs and, healthcare professional employment. If there's a massive shortage of healthcare professionals, which is, you ask any economic developer across our state and they'll say that they're probably most highly in demand and undersupplied. There's a shortage in the market. So if you're not going to be able to employ those healthcare professionals, all of the downstream benefits that the University of Alabama study promises aren't going to be there. There's not the slack that you might see, say, in the construction industry right now, where many construction workers are laid off. That's not the case for healthcare in our state and healthcare nationally as well. So what you're going to see are longer lines. You're going to see a backlog of appointments. You're going to see people being rejected from treatments at some of the leading places and having to go elsewhere. But none of that is actually generating a lot of new income for the state.
So again, just to reiterate what you're saying, if this same amount of money, this millions and millions of dollars, I guess billions of dollars over the long run, was to be invested into the state to, say, build roads, and we'll just pick that out of thin air, to build roads, it would potentially make jobs, create jobs, because there are people who will build roads, et cetera, out of work right now who could be hired to do such a thing. When you bring this money in under the guise of Medicaid expansion, there's not a bunch of doctors sitting on the sidelines saying, okay, here we go.
That's exactly right. So it's an issue about the labor market for healthcare professionals that really takes down all of the claims being made both in the UAB and the Alabama studies, because if you don't have the job creation, you don't get the wonderful tax implications that we're also challenging. None of that happens if, in fact, there's a lot of rigidity in the market.
Now, when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with you, and we'll continue to ask some of the questions about the study and some of the other things. And we'll get away from some of the politics, but it's kind of hard to separate this from politics and the Affordable Care Act, since this is basically where all of this comes from. But before I take this break, Scott, let's one more time. Scott Moyer, Troy State, or excuse me, from Troy, joining us to talk about this. Your study refutes the study from UAB and the study from Alabama. Is that your holding? Is that your view here?
We would say that, yeah. So I think that that's correct. If it doesn't refute, it certainly presents an alternative. And maybe people can find middle ground. We look at other states as well. And four other states in the Southeast that look a lot like us, our results are very, very close to theirs. And it's the UAB study that's the real outlier in terms of its results.
We'll come back with Scott Moyer from Troy University as we continue this morning. But right now, let's check in with our good friend Conrad Thompson over there at First Family Mortgage. You don't need to use fancy math or numbers or skewed statistics to know that you may be paying too much for your mortgage. You just need to call Conrad Thompson at First Family Mortgage. Right, Conrad?
That's exactly right, Dale. And here it is. It comes down very simply. It's not just a matter of what's your interest rate. What really matters is, what are you paying for your house? And I don't mean what did you pay the guy who used to live there. I mean, how many monthly payments did you sign up for, and what's your monthly payment? Let's see if we can get you a better monthly payment, not only from a cheaper standpoint every month, but let's have fewer of the house payments. It seems like a really novel idea, and it will save you a ton of cash. We just helped the family over in Decatur do exactly that, and they knocked off 61 house payments. So really process that. Imagine what your payment is. You know what it is, to the penny. You write that check each and every month. It's your single biggest bill. Imagine that times 61. That's what the family in Decatur saved. And here's the best part of all. With our new program called Your Choice, they're going to keep the exact same monthly payment. So in July, they're going to write the exact to-the-dollar payment that they've been paying for years. But now they have 61 fewer payments. Why wouldn't you do that? To not do that is to just throw your money away. Get a long-term plan together. What does the end of your mortgage look like? We can help you do that this morning on your ride to work. It's no cost, no obligation. And here's the worst-case scenario. We say, you know what, man? You're doing pretty good. Keep doing what you're doing. But what if we could save you 61 house payments? It would save you a small fortune. Don't delay. Give us a call this morning on your ride to work at 425-0105.
There you go, folks. It's that simple. You call Conrad Thompson. That guy saves you money. He knows what he's doing. 425-0105. That's 425-0105. You can also check him out online at 1FMC.com. But remember, when you call Conrad Thompson, you need to give him 10 minutes of your time. He'll save you a ton of money. NMLS number 65084, an equal housing lender. Call Conrad Thompson. Call First Family Mortgage. And when you do, make sure you tell him Dale Jackson sent you. On the line with us right now, let's jump right back into it. From Troy, we have with us Scott Moyer. He is part of the study where folks have come to the conclusion, at least in their study, that this is not going to be a giant winner for the state of Alabama. This is not some giant government program where they're just going to dump money into the state and everyone's going to say, yay, pour money on us, and then the economy is going to be great. Medicaid is already slowly choking the state of Alabama. Talk to any of the legislators who deal with budgets. It's a big issue here. It's not going to create a bunch of jobs. There's going to be a bunch of problems that come along with it. Let's transition past that part, Scott, and let's talk a little bit about Governor Bentley and apparently one of his task force have come up with another plan here, and that plan is sort of a managed model, a plan that's a little bit different. Is that possible, the Medicaid to a managed care model? Is that possible? What would that do?
Well, managed care has worked pretty well in the places it's been tried. There was a pilot program down in Florida that experimented with four counties, and it led to significant cost savings for taxpayers. It led to very similar results in terms of care. So it's not that you're just gutting treatments from people. It's that managed care actually has an incentive to hold and stick to a bottom line. Medicaid, when it's being managed through hospitals with basically easy and loose budget constraints, tends to have cost overruns and a strong incentive to just keep driving up the number of treatments people get. So it's a step in the right direction. I think that there are a number of other things that also have to be entertained when you're getting serious about controlling costs of Medicaid. The big one is actually just co-payments and encouraging people to respond a bit to the market incentives of price.
Well, and I think that's the key part here. That would include Medicaid money. I guess if Utah was able to do this first, and then, so is there any talk of doing a different study involving this one?
You know, we would be interested in doing something like that out of our center here. We're bogged down at the moment in this Medicaid debate and also kind of looking at the DSH payment. But there are, you know, it's very interesting to just kind of go from what we did to say, well, what alternatives are there for the poor? And there's a number of things that could be done, you know, and the one of the big ones, like you mentioned, Utah, is just adjusting the co-payments. I was just in for one of my children in the pediatrician's office, and the co-payments for people on Medicaid were $1 from $0 to $50 of expense, $2 from $50 to $100, and then anything over $100, it was a $3.50 copay. That really doesn't encourage good stewardship or use of the pediatrician's office, and it's kind of symptomatic of our broader problems.
We talk about the Utah situation, and I guess they have to figure out if they're going to be able to do that first and pull it off, and then whether Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act will fit in there, if they'll approve it. I mean, it's just there's a big issue there that goes along with all of this. I guess the bigger issue here is, can this survive? You got guys like Dr. Griffith who are running around the state saying that, you know, if this doesn't pass, hospitals will close. Or if this isn't used, hospitals will close. And he said 8 have closed. I said, no, Dr. Griffith, 10 have closed. 10 rural hospitals have closed. Would Medicaid, would that expansion do anything to save those rural hospitals?
Well, it might prop them up for a little bit longer, but the issue with those rural hospitals is that if you're counting on Medicaid expanding to keep you in business, you probably have like a fundamental problem in your structure and in basically your management of costs and revenue. So a federal program being used as a band-aid for your local and rural issues is really a bad solution. Even here in Troy, you know, the notion of going to some of the rural hospitals in the area here is something that nobody would do. Even in an emergency, they'd say, take my chances and get me to Montgomery. That's a reputational problem that the Medicaid expansion shouldn't be involved in fixing.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. And again, I want to go back to the study here for just a second. Yellowhammer News had a very good write-up on this, and they said there are three flaws with the study. The first flaw, UAB study treats Medicaid expenditures as taxable. They are not. Why'd they do that then? Was it to boost the numbers to get a better headline? If UAB is treating Medicaid expenditures as taxable when they do their study and they're not, that's going to throw the entire study off, correct?
It would, yeah. So you can't count that direct transmission of money into hospitals as taxable, and they do that. And then it trickles on down from there to get a really big number as a result. So that's the first area that we take issue with.
Now, that's one part. There are more to it. The UAB study uses an 8.6 tax rate to reach its conclusion. That means they included local taxes in their assumption, which are not a funding source for Medicaid. The Troy study says 5.4 would be a more accurate number, and that's what you guys use. Why'd they use 8.6? I mean, was this an intentional attempt? I mean, I don't know if you'll say this. Was this an intentional attempt to cook the books?
I have no idea, but you know, you can go right next door to the University of Georgia. Georgia State University did a study just like ours. They strip out local taxes as well. You know, and they're in the 5% ballpark in terms of total taxes collected. If you were to instead use Census Bureau data, we could have taken our number and our assumption with a very good case for doing so all the way down to 3.3%. That's actually the income tax collected in the state of Alabama. There are so many deductions and, you know, so many loopholes that we only collect about 3.3% on income. So we actually feel like we're being pretty charitable to UAB by using 5.4.
Was your study done as a direct response? I mean, that's what it sounds like, and I think that was Griffin's point too. Was it done as a direct response, a correction? How would you say it?
Well, you know, first thing we wanted to do was just get under the hood and take a look at what they did, and then when you see these problems with some of the assumptions that they were making, we offered up an alternative that we felt like was a conservative alternative. We could have gone even more aggressive with our analysis and come up with a bigger negative number and said, here's the real spectrum. But we felt like we were positioning ourselves, somewhat moderately in the middle in terms of our results, and just trying to say that there's room for questioning the UAB study. It's been taken as just this be-all, end-all study, and that's really what we took issue with, is that one study and one set of numbers could possibly be truth. And that's, that this is science, and I think Griffith should understand that given his background.
Scott Boyer, Troy University, thank you very much for joining us. We talked to him a lot over the last few weeks, and we'll continue to have a conversation with him about the issue of Medicaid expansion in Alabama, especially as it becomes an issue in the governor's race and different races for state rep and state senate. Just a little clarification. I've reached out to Alabama and to UAB, and we will do so again and try to find someone from their group to talk, but they're not interested. They are more interested in just putting their study out and letting it hang out there, and I think that's one of the reasons why this Troy study is getting a little more attention. They're willing to talk about it, and I think that makes complete sense. A little update on the Lowell Barron case in North Alabama up here. Appeals court judges withdraw from hearing appeal in Lowell Barron case. What their reasoning is, we'll have to get down to that. But Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore will have to pick someone to help decide how far the state's attorney general's office can go in exploring the relationship between a former state senator and campaign aide charged with misusing campaign funds. Stay tuned. We'll get into it.